This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Hello and welcome to The Feed with Amber Mack
and Michael B. for everything new now and next.
We have you covered for what's happening in the world of tech and what's trending online.
On the show, we'll tell you which Chinese city is now saying yes to driverless cars.
Plus, speaking of China, why U.S. lawmakers are once again trying to curb the rise of TikTok.
Also on the show, we take you inside life at the International Space Station.
And coming up in Apptastic, a weather app that's tied to your personal schedule.
That's all coming up right here on The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B.
Trending up.
It's been another big week. It's summertime if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. August is here, my friend. Amber Mack, how the devil are you?
I am doing great. I cannot believe that the summer seemed to be flying by so quickly, but so far so good. The weather's been pretty great where I am. I'm in Toronto now, and I was just in Prince Edward Island, and you know, it's been a busy summer. I don't know if you find this, Michael, but I used to find that summers would really slow down, but I'm finding with people working now from everywhere, when they're on vacation at the cottage, that you know, business continues to be steady, which is a good thing. I'm not complaining, but is that your experience?
Yeah, and I think business seems to be steady, but what I find is when you're younger, things went slower. When you're older, anything fun goes faster. So if you are looking forward to even 4 minutes to yourself, it goes by so fast. So then if it's a day or 2 days, or if you're very lucky to have a week, it goes by so fast and in a blink of an eye. So I think the lesson here is to enjoy any moment you can when you don't have to work and you don't have any commitments.
Yes, I think that's a fair statement. I think it's just obvious that time goes so quickly. The older you get, it just seems like everything is just on.
You look in the mirror and you're like, who is that? That's what happened to me. I'm going to be 42. I think by the time the show airs, I will have had my birthday. 42. And I looked in the mirror and I went, holy mother o' my, that is a middle-aged person.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that later. Okay. So a lot of big stories over the past week. Like I said, I think things don't really slow down as much as they used to. This is a big one about what's taking place with TikTok and China and the United States. So according to this CNN article, they talk about the fact that what we're seeing at this point is that there is still a lot of pressure from U.S. lawmakers against TikTok. So many saying that it presents a national security and data privacy concerns combined. And knowing the popularity of TikTok in the United States, which is rising, especially among a younger population, there is that fear once again that TikTok needs to somehow, I don't know if they want to limit it, if they want to ban it. I'm sure there's a range of proposed solutions to this. But I think at the end of the day, Michael, we're showing and we're seeing more and more that when it comes to these large technology companies, it's increasingly difficult to really determine how they can operate digitally on a global scale.
Yeah, and it's really tough too, because obviously TikTok, as it's operating, is trying to do its best from a global perspective, but obviously its parent company is beholden to Chinese law and Chinese government regulations. And so obviously they're very different to other countries around the world. So that's one big challenge that they face. And then, as you alluded to, from a United States perspective, it's this ongoing concern about how TikTok represents itself when it comes to data security and data processing and all of the corporate governance practices. And obviously they're saying that they're not in line with, say, the way an American jurisdiction would do it. And so they're obviously concerned. I guess my big question is, do you think people care enough from a young perspective or understand the implications? Because obviously they just see the shiny, fun tool that TikTok is. Do they understand enough to care about the data security and the privacy concerns and that bigger picture?
Yeah, I think the answer is no. I think, you know, they note in this article, and this is probably worth mentioning, that TikTok has moved its U.S. User data to U.S.-based cloud services. So that means that all of the content is now being hosted in the United States. TikTok says this addresses some of those security concerns. But I really think at the end of the day, I think what we're seeing right now is that, you know, individuals, especially a younger generation, maybe don't care as much about some of these platforms that they're using or the effects on them. But that's probably pretty standard, and it's probably the responsibility of adults in the room to do a better job.
Absolutely. Now, this is really interesting. So Uber is one of many companies that had reported their earnings recently. Now, of course, Uber's bookings have hit an all-time high in the last 3 months. And that's, of course, because of all of the easing of COVID-19 restrictions, a lot more people heading back to work. So I don't think there was any surprise if you were comparing it to this time last year. And of course, in 2021, not a lot of people were moving about and going places and doing things. So, but it is interesting that obviously Uber for a very long time has been having record amounts of debt. And so it does seem that they're doing better in some areas. Obviously, they've extended themselves into grocery delivery business and all kinds of things as well.
Yeah, and it's worth noting in this article from CNBC that a lot of people maybe don't know this, but they may think Uber makes most of its money from people moving from one place to another. But what we see from this latest report is that when it comes to mobility, those are those gross bookings of Uber for the second quarter 2022, it was about $13.4 billion, but delivery was $13.9 billion. So a little bit higher than that. And you're right. I mean, that's not just groceries, but of course, restaurant delivery. So it is fascinating to me to see this side of their business outperform the mobility side. And I think this is something that's going to probably continue.
Yeah. And what was surprising to me was there was a recent number out that almost 5 million people are now picking up passengers and delivering groceries by working for Uber. Almost 5 million people. That is a lot of people globally working for Uber and, you know, working in the mobility space.
Absolutely. Okay, so we just have about a minute left. We wanted to stick to this transportation theme. And I talked about this in my newsletter this week. Reuters had shared this article that a city in China has really accelerated the driverless car pursuits. In fact, they have in Shenzhen, they've given about 50,000 trial rides to passengers in the past year in these autonomous vehicles. So as of this past Monday, this is kind of fascinating, so autonomous vehicles will be allowed to operate without someone actually driving in the driver's seat. There has to be a driver present, but this is a pretty big announcement in terms of regulation around the future of autonomous vehicles.
It certainly is. And it will be interesting to see how this actually is deployed, because obviously all of the infrastructure and everything that's supposed to be around this to support this type of technology isn't there yet. So it will be interesting to see just how it goes assimilating into the current driving infrastructure as well. Of course, we've got tons more ahead on the show. When we return, we tell you about a library fight that is breaking up book lovers.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. In the Spotlight.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Just how are libraries allowed to buy and lend out digital books to the public? And what does it mean for the future of online lending? Well, to help us answer these questions, Brewster Kale is the founder and is a digital librarian for the Internet Archive and is joining us now. Now, let's start with old school. We used to go to a library. We would get a physical book. We would borrow it. We would take it home. We didn't really think anything of it because we know people would buy the book and be able to do that. How does it differ when it comes to borrowing literature and books online?
Well, it turns out that the big publishers never liked the idea of libraries lending books, or in many ways, even libraries, coming from statements from their trade association, which is kind of awful. But anyway, it existed for a long time because Ben Franklin really started it off, that we could, you know, libraries could buy a book, own a book, preserve a book, and lend it one patron at a time. So when the digital libraries started coming about, we in the library field wanted to buy electronic books, but the big publishers wouldn't do it. The indie publishers are perfectly happy to, but the big publishers said, no. We don't want to sell you an ebook in the same sense of a book. We want to license it to you, and you can only use it in exactly the way that we tell you. And we're going to be able to take that book back at any time or change it, even though it's on your shelves and you've paid for it. This didn't strike us as right. So we buy the Internet Archive, and now there's hundreds of other libraries buy all the eBooks that we can and lend them, but they don't, it's only the small publishers. But now we said, okay, let's go and take our digital books, most of which are way out of print, digitize them and lend them one reader at a time, the same kind of way, and using the same protections that the publishers did. This has been going on for 10 years. Hundreds of libraries have been doing it, but they got upset a couple of years ago at the beginning of the pandemic.
Why do you think that they got upset? Obviously, it has something to do with profits, but what was kind of the tipping point?
Actually, it doesn't look like it's profits. It looks like it's all about control. So they want to make it so that every reading event online is a permissioned event. They want to make sure that only the people that they want to have access to things in the exact way that they want it, which is kind of the, it's not what we dreamed of for the internet. We thought the internet was going to be a democratizing thing, which empowers more people to do more different things. But it also has this other dark side that allows extremely large corporations to control exactly what you're going to see. And we're seeing this not just in the big tech companies, but in these big publishers. So why did they get upset? I think it's control. And it came out, they sued the Internet Archive, but as a proxy for the hundreds of other libraries, MIT, Harvard, Boston Public Library, all of these other libraries that are doing this function, they're trying to basically pick off the Internet Archive, have the judge rule against the idea of digitally owning materials and lending them out as libraries do, and stopping this practice.
Does this affect the authors in any way? And the only reason I ask is obviously they are the creators of the work. Does it have something to do with the copyright and ensuring they still earn what they're owed for the published books or works of art?
Yes, it absolutely does. And so the authors get paid by publishers. That's how it works in this country. That's the only way it works. They get paid by publishers, and they have been completely, well, squeezed by the publishers. Often they're squeezed out of electronic royalties at all. So what libraries do is they spend, there's about $25 billion a year in the United States is spent on libraries. We love libraries. And about a quarter of that goes to publishers' products, right? So the libraries flood the publishing industry with money that basically keeps trade publishing, reference publishing going. And the publishers then make deals with authors. And often the authors get almost nothing. And they're getting less and less as the consolidation of publishing is getting more and more. So there are now only basically five big trade publishers. There are only three big academic publishers. This isn't your mom and pop publishers that you all remember. These are not the cozy deals between authors and publishers. These are mega conglomerates. One of the companies suing the Internet Archive is owned by Rupert Murdoch, to give you kind of the idea of the scale of the organizations that we're now contending with. And these publishers pick who gets to be published and who doesn't. And these tentacles go everywhere. So even people that are in newspapers or the like, they all want a book deal. Are they going to go and write something that is negative to the big five book publishers? they'll maybe think about it. So we have a control over what authors are writing, what they're paid, all through the publishers. And libraries basically flood that money with that system with money that should go more to authors than it is. And if we end up squashing libraries, then a lot of that money won't go to authors.
We just have about a minute left. So from an individual's perspective who is listening to this right now, why do you think they should learn more about this and keep up to date on what's going on?
It's part of the whole control of the narrative of what's going on, of what stories get told, what gets seen. I think we're seeing a lot of push against the tech companies. Apparently they're going and filtering something or others. And I think that the big publishers have more control over what we see than is generally known. So I think that we should be fighting to make for powerful, independent and strong library system. Just in Oklahoma today, they're not allowed to say the word abortion to their patrons. So that's coming from the government angle. And we now have publishers pulling books from libraries' bookshelves electronically because of different pressures. So I think we've got an information ecosystem problem in this country that is underreported. So I'm so glad that you're reporting on.
Well, listen, we are so glad that you took time to join us on the feed and really break this down, and we will keep on top of the story. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Up next, a new network to help connect Hollywood creatives.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167. Aptastic.
Welcome back to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. We're going to take a look at some new and trending apps to help you connect with a professional community. If you are a creator, an app that will help you with forecasts, and even an app that will help you a little bit with your upcoming meals. So, Michael, this first one that you had mentioned in this list, which I had a chance to check out, is called Hustle Up. That's HUSSLUP. So not an obvious spelling, but nonetheless, it's by creatives for creatives. So the idea is that if you are a producer or a writer or someone who works in the entertainment industry, this is a platform that will connect you with companies that could be hiring other creators in that space. So to me, Michael, this feels like sort of a neglected group of people, in the sense that the tech community has its own platforms for jobs. But when it comes to these people in the production industry, it feels like this is probably something that could do phenomenally well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's not only helping profile yourself and grow and expand your network, but obviously looking and finding those people that you need to crew for specific projects. So it, you can sort things through the different features where you've got your professional profile. There's a live feed where you can post job opportunities. And if you're looking to collaborate with people or post industry news so people are kept in the know, of course, you can start your own groups to help either upskill or keep relevant in different areas and fields. So it's really quite a specific platform and niche, but fantastic for creatives, as you said, because obviously it doesn't seem to be out there a platform specifically for them.
Yeah, I was watching, I don't watch a lot of TV, but last night I was watching The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. And it's such a fun and informative show. And there is a difference between watching online content and highly produced television content, right? You can just feel the production values are so much better. And obviously the resources, it's just a totally different experience and the scale at which they're able to put out shows. So it's still there's some cool stuff still happening in that space, despite the obvious fragmentation.
Yeah, and I think that people have to do remember, and I've been saying this for years before content creators, you know, became like everybody is one and influencers. It's like premium content will always rise to the top. And we're seeing that now flipping back to how important premium content is. And as you mentioned, at that level, it is to find those people, those creatives, they need a platform. This platform is perfect for them, and it verifies their credits, and it does all of the checks and ensures, you know, they are who they say they are, and they have the experience and the ability to deliver. So it's a great one. Hustle up.
Very cool. Okay. So next up, wanted to talk about an app, Michael, that is basically a weather app. But what I love about this is that it gives you weather based on your personal calendar. So this has won a number of awards from Lifehacker, The Verge, TechCrunch, CNET, Entrepreneur, which is always a good thing. And I really think this is cool how it ties into what's happening in your own personal schedule, because really that's where weather becomes relevant. If I'm sitting at home, I don't really care all that much what's happening.
Exactly. And so this is what differentiates it from all of the other weather apps that we've talked about previously on the show. It's that synchronization to your calendar to ensure that wherever you're going, you know exactly what kind of weather you're in for so you can prepare for it. So that's probably the biggest difference. Obviously, it has some other great features. It has your hourly and 10-day forecast like you would expect. It's got a weather map with radar. It's beautifully designed. So it's very simple to use. You can easily share weather conditions and maps as well with friends, especially if you do have groups of people going to a certain outing. You can give them a heads up. I know that is exceptionally important for people with kids when you have to prepare for more than yourself. So it's a really neat app. And of course, there is a pro subscription component in this app as well, if you would like some extra features.
Yeah. So, I mean, just think about it like this. It looks like it's available for iOS users specifically, but I love how they show you kind of a snapshot of your calendar. So if you have soccer practice or an outdoor concert coming up, basically it shows you that and the weather that is being forecasted for that specific day. Like if you have a hiking trip, you know, for example, it says there's a possible rain showers coming up. And of course, weather changes, so don't freak out if it's wrong, but it's a pretty good indication in terms of how to prepare.
It certainly is. All right, let's head to the kitchen, my friend.
Yeah. So this is called Whisk, which is a great name for an app. Hundreds of thousands of downloads already. And again, this is an award-winning app, which is always a good thing. And the idea is it's basically your own personal cookbook. So you can pull recipes, unlike some apps where they're proprietary in nature, where it's all about their recipes. The idea with this app is that you can pull recipes from other websites or even cooking apps. And you can basically have recipe edits. You can kind of manipulate some of those recipes if you maybe used a different ingredient. So it feels to me like it allows you to basically take all of your favorite recipes from different locations, but add your own personal touch if there's things that maybe you've learned or want to do differently. So it's not a static recipe app, but one that is very malleable.
Yeah, and also there's lots of neat features that are packed into this app. So obviously, very easy to find your own personal recipe collection. You can turn that into a weekly meal plan. Obviously, if you're a huge planner, you could then use that weekly meal plan in a couple of clicks. It can actually then ensure that your recipe or meal plan is turned into a smart shopping list. So then when you do go to the grocery store, you don't miss anything that then links to the weekly meals that you would like to prepare. So really makes it easy, and it's quite seamless as well. It also has details on all of the nutritional value of the meals that you are cooking, including calorie counts for those people that need to be keeping an extra eye on things if you've gone a little crazy over the holidays.
Yeah. And I don't know this to be true because I haven't tried this in the app, but it appears to me as one example that if you saw a recipe on Facebook or TikTok, you would then just go and bring up your app icons and kind of hit Whisk and then add that recipe. So that's sort of a use case scenario as far as how this works. And I just love that idea because it is frustrating. You know, all these people share this great content about cooking and recipe ideas and everything. And it's kind of a cumbersome process to email yourself all the details and then try to keep
exactly.
up. So it is fun that you're able to do this all in one place. So Michael, some really cool and useful apps, including some award winners.
Yeah, exactly. And just with the cooking app, obviously you can substitute ingredients, like you said, and you can also adjust serving sizes, which I've started to do, because as you get older, you need to be more careful on your portion when it comes to eating. So that's another little helpful hint that I've learned in the last couple of weeks. So those three apps are Hustle Up. And of course, we've got the Weather Up app. And the last one is Whisk. And of course, if you've got an app, gadget, or product you think we should check out, tweet us at AmberMac and at AmBancroft80 and use the hashtag TheFeed. Coming up, we introduce you to a new electric robot valet.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Techstar.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Charging your electric car and even parking are becoming easier thanks to robots like Ziggy, developed by EV Safe Charge. You can manage all of this through their app. And to share more about how this works is the company's founder and CEO, Caradoc Ehrenhalt. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. And let's talk about Ziggy. How does this work?
Thank you so much for having me. So Ziggy is poised to be the world's first mobile robotic EV charger with communication and advertising that comes to you instead of you going to the charger.
Now, this is fantastic. And when this popped up and I found this, I thought this was perfect to talk about because I was just telling Amber in the break, I charged for the very first time an electric car. And it was hilarious. I didn't know what I was doing. It was pretty simple because I was in London and they have a charging station, some lamp posts, but it's not common. And it is quite difficult if you really don't know what you're doing. So how does Ziggy make it easy? Because I would have loved Ziggy to zoom up and have done it for me.
So Ziggy really answers the charging anxiety that is one of the barriers to mass EV adoption. And so the whole idea is to just make it very, very easy. So you can summon Ziggy before you get to your destination and it will save a parking space for you. You then get there, it pulls out, you pull in, it pulls in behind you, and then you charge up. It lets you know when it's done, you unplug and go on your way. And then Ziggy is ready to go charge another vehicle or go to its home base for recharging or to be picked up for charging offsite if no infrastructure is available or desired onsite.
It is so smart and so obvious that I'm just surprised now when I look around the city of Toronto that I'm seeing all of these static charging stations. And you're right, you know, you might have one or two per parking lot, and then all of a sudden, not everybody can take advantage of charging, as one example. So can you talk a little bit about the best locations or scenarios in terms of Ziggy being its most efficient?
Yes. So Ziggy is designed to be used in parking lots all over the world. So Toronto is a perfect example. And especially in older buildings, a lot of them don't have enough power to put in a lot of charging, even though we want to put in more and more charging. And so that really is a perfect use is any commercial setting, multi-dwelling units, so multi-family apartments, condos, et cetera.
Now, I know this might sound like a really silly question, and I only just charged my very first electric car. So, like, are all the plugs the same? And I only ask that because obviously I'm usually based in Toronto, but I'm currently in London. And with any other device, I would have to take all of my different international adapters.
Yes. So it's similar. So chargers are different around the world. There are a few different standards. And then Ziggy will have the standard that is applicable to the region that it's in. So it will work with all cars all over the world.
It is amazing. So as I just watched the video, and I know this is an audio show, so it's hard for people to imagine what Ziggy looks like. But I'm curious, what infrastructure is needed for Ziggy to get its own charge? You mentioned that maybe it's not as intensive as typically installing a unit. So what does Ziggy need on these locations at these parking lots?
So numerous Ziggies can recharge off of the same infrastructure on site. So they go around the parking lot, they come back to the one home base, which is much easier for the site than having to run conduit all over the parking lot. And then in a lot of older buildings in the world, there just simply is not enough power to allow for any charging, in which case Ziggy can just be picked up, charged offsite, and freshly charged Ziggies get dropped off.
Sorry to get all nerdy, and again, only because I'm learning about battery life and how long things take. How long or how much can Ziggy charge for before it needs to charge itself? And how long does it take Ziggy to charge itself?
Yes. So Ziggy provides 200 miles of range. And so it can charge multiple cars for a few miles up to the 200 miles before being recharged. And then between cars, it can go and recharge. So it can always stay full, or it can charge sort of at the end of the day after it's depleted. Most drivers in urban settings drive 30 miles a day or less. And so Ziggy provides for charging when someone is at a business meeting, at the mall, et cetera. And most cars, depending on how fast they can intake the charging on a level two rate, will be able to do somewhere between half an hour and an hour on a level two rate of what Ziggy is providing to them.
So
for the 30 miles.
I guess the big question in terms of all of this is, how do we convince the owners of parking lots or apartment buildings or shopping centers to invest in something like this? Because it feels to me as though we're moving too slowly in terms of being able to meet the demands of electric vehicle drivers.
Ziggy is amazing because it showcases that a company is forward-thinking and green and cares about the environment and their customers, employees, visitors, et cetera. And so I think it's about the demand and people adopting electric vehicles, and more people are requesting the charging to be at the sites where they go. So for example, an office building leases out space to a tenant. The tenant says, we have EV drivers, we want more charging. And today that's very difficult and can take a long time to put in, but with a mobile solution that can happen very quickly. So it's a little bit of the push from the EV drivers. Certainly you can have subsidies that help a lot while people are installing the infrastructure, and a combination of all of those things, including so many more people driving EVs, letting the sites know they really have to put in more infrastructure.
And just before we let you go, just to reiterate, so it's charging agnostic, and everything is super easy and manageable via an app, a platform that's already built in.
Yes, exactly. So it's an app on your phone or in your car infotainment system to call Ziggy in advance of the parking. You could also be in a parking lot and then say, oh, hey, I need a charge. Come meet me at space 39, for example, and then Ziggy will come meet you. So it's all about making it very, very easy for the driver to charge up.
A last question. I know Michael said that that was possibly the last question, but I just have a quick one for you. I live in downtown Toronto in a home on a street where many of us don't have driveways. Is there the potential for something like Ziggy to service areas like that? I know it would be a sidewalk in terms of the infrastructure, but it feels to me as though those communities could also take advantage of tech like this.
Absolutely. It's a great solution for that. And then not only can Ziggy charge up EVs as we think about them today, but it can charge up scooters, e-bikes, et cetera. And so, and because it has this for the cities, for the communities, you can offer advertising maybe on one side. So for cars driving by, et cetera, bicycles. And then on the other side, you can have interactive maps, information about the neighborhood and all of that. So it's really made also for those public settings.
It's so cool. Well, thank you so much for starting this company. And hopefully we see these robots everywhere in the near future. And thanks for joining us on the feed.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's great to be with you.
Up next, how to go on a spacewalk with astronauts in virtual reality.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. In the Spotlight.
This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Space Explorers, the ISS experience, is a four-part immersive experience that takes you inside life at the International Space Station. It's very cool. Felix and Paul is the production studio behind the Emmy award-winning series, and Paul Raphael is the co-founder of the company, and he's joining us now. This is pretty special and exceptionally, just the experience itself and what you guys have been able to create with the technology. Can you start with the technology itself, what you're using and how you were able to make it so lifelike, as if you're really there on the space station?
Yeah, I mean, we've been building virtual reality cameras since we began our studio almost 10 years ago now, and it really was with a focus on recreating reality, capturing reality, actually, with as much fidelity as possible. So obviously, over the last 10 years, we've made a lot of progress, and we've basically continued this tradition all the way up to sending these cameras up on the International Space Station. So we're capturing 360 degrees with the full volume at the correct scale of reality, and we've been filming up there for close to 3 years now, on board the ISS and off board the ISS, two different models, one of which is a lot more basically was a lot harder to design because it needed to withstand the vacuum of space. But yeah, basically we're capturing as close as you can get to being up there without actually being up there.
Could you talk a little bit about this interactive experience that you have built? Because I think, as Michael mentioned in the introduction, there is that kind of four-part series, but there is also coming up in September this incredible VR live stream. So how do you describe this to people in terms of what you are creating and offering? It's not like they can just watch a show, but again, it's much more immersive.
Absolutely. So the Infinite really was a way to combine, basically we wanted to get the best of both worlds in terms of what virtual reality can offer. So cinematic virtual reality can capture reality just as it is, but it doesn't give you as much freedom to interact, to move, it doesn't have much of a social aspect, but interactive virtual reality, so real-time rendered, think of video games, they allow you to walk around, to interact with other people, with other objects. And the Infinite was all about basically merging these two aspects of virtual reality. This was the first time we were doing it. And as far as I know, it's the first time it was done at that scale. So we have a space that allows us to have, it's big enough to fit a virtual International Space Station at one-to-one scale. So you're basically walking around. It's a stylized rendition of the ISS. You can see yourself as a stylized avatar. You can see your friends, your family as avatars as well. You can interact with them, and you see all the other visitors wandering around the ISS as well. And as you basically explore the ISS, there are these floating orbs that you can touch, and these will activate the filmed content that was filmed on board the ISS. So you go from this stylized rendition, interactive, to the lifelike photorealistic captures that we actually did on the ISS.
What were some of the hurdles that surprised you in creating this experience?
Oh my God. This is basically a 6-year odyssey that brought us to this project. I mean, first of all, while this was a dream of ours to be able to film up there, since the inception of the studio, really, as soon as we had our very first images that we were able to capture and put in a virtual reality headset, we're like, space, we need to bring these cameras to space. We need to be able to share this experience that very few people can have with as many people here on Earth as possible. Of course, that included ourselves at the time, and today as well. We haven't actually been to space yet, but our equipment has, and it has been able to capture this content. So, obviously that was a dream back then. First, we had to get in touch with, the likes of NASA, the Canadian Space Agency, build a relationship with them. We started working with them, learning, the how do you collaborate with such entities? You know, all the logistics that go with that, building the trust, building the technology. Of course, we started filming with them down here on Earth a few years ago with Space Explorers, the documentary series, you know, documenting astronaut training, telling the story of this new era of space exploration. And then eventually we had a green light to, I'm simplifying things here a lot, but to center our cameras onto the ISS. That meant actually designing these cameras and really understanding all the challenges that you know, both in the certification process, from a technology standpoint, the physics of it all, you know, getting those cameras up there. And then repeating all of that with this different design, the second camera that was sent outside the ISS. And that's, you know, that's the capturing the footage part. The exhibit itself also required us to innovate on a number of levels. First of all, there has never been an experience with that many simultaneous users in VR at the same time, interacting with each other. You know, there's a technical challenge there. There's obviously a creative challenge of, you know, what do you do with that? You know, like, this is, it's not like we have a, there's no manual to how to build such an experience, neither from a technical nor a creative level. So we had to do a lot of prototyping, a lot of testing, you know, what is your body like? What can you do? What can't you do? How do you make sure people don't bump into each other? I mean, we were designing this during COVID, well, not that COVID is necessarily over, but we had to really make sure that people could see each other and be able to maintain their distances. And then the whole logistics of how do you manage 100, 200 VR headsets that need to be, you know, constantly charged, not overheating, networked properly, cleaned. You know, we have these UV cleaning stations that we actually made part of the scenery because they looked so cool. You know, the being able to remotely control all this, because we knew this was going to tour the world and we weren't going to be able to tour with it. Those are just some of the challenges we faced.
We just have about 30 seconds left, and I'm sorry for leaving such a big question to the last, but in 30 seconds or less, can you tell us, a lot of people are skeptical of VR. Is it true that not all VR is created equal?
Well, not all anything is created equal. That kind of goes without saying. I think in terms of you know, comfort, you need to be very, very, very mindful of how you create your content so that people can be comfortable within it. In terms of, you know, impact, you know, especially at this era where people still need to be convinced about the medium, you need to be very careful about, you know, you need to blow people's mind the first time they put a VR headset on, because, you know, the technology is still evolving, and so the content really needs to be as good as it can be so that people, you know, can start adopting it. And, you know, there's a chicken and egg thing here where you need people to buy in so that there's an industry for this content to exist. And the Infinite is really a way for us to make this medium as accessible as possible, to get people as excited about the medium as possible, so that they maybe go out and buy themselves a headset after visiting our show.
Well, listen, it's very cool technology, a really amazing experience. So thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it on the feed.
Thank you very much for having me.
Up next, we dive into the tech companies that are built to fail versus built to last.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Socially Speaking.
It's time now for Socially Speaking, and this week we are going to talk about a topic that had a brief chance to dive into in my weekly newsletter, and it was all about technology that is built to last versus technology that is built to fail. I don't know about you guys, Aaron and Michael, but sometimes you see something or you observe something in the wild and you think to yourself, wow, that is really interesting. My observation was that my son has been collecting old technology. He got his hands on a yellow Sony Sports Walkman in July of this year. He got the Walkman, he put some batteries in, and then he put an old cassette in that he got at a garage sale, and the thing worked. Now, you may think, of course it did, because it just works. But could you ever take technology of today that is that old, and I'm talking decades, and expect it to work. You would never, ever expect that. Michael, maybe I'll start with you. I mean, it is clear to me that technology used to be built to last versus built to fail or planned obsolescence.
That's how they make the money. We've talked about it all the time on the show, and it is quite remarkable how in this day and age and how advanced technology is, how quickly it becomes obsolete or doesn't work, or it's specifically built so you have to buy the next model or the next version or iteration of the product that you then are suddenly so heavily reliant on. I do miss a good old Walkman, not gonna lie.
Aaron, what is your experience? I mean, as someone in the audio world of professional production, does this surprise you at all? Is it frustrating?
I had a similar experience with my own son. He found my old original 1989 Game Boy at my parents' house, the black and white Game Boy, or if you were there, you know, it's actually green and green. It's not black and white, it's green and green. And as long as there are fresh batteries in it, it worked perfectly. And I was surprised that my son was so interested in it because he knows the specs of all the consoles and the frame rates and the frame per second and the processor speeds. He doesn't just like to play the games. He likes to know what's inside the guts of the boxes of the consoles. And yet not only did the Game Boy work with fresh batteries, but he was impressed with the games as well. I being an old person myself, in quotes there, I remember there used to be electronics repair shops for anything from TVs, stereos, your toaster, whatever. Now it seems we only repair our phones and our laptops. Some people's phones are their life for business, not just personal. Same with some people's laptops. And I've, you know, dropped my phone a couple times and replaced the screen. I know there's bigger jobs that could go inside the guts of the phone than that. And there's a licensed Apple repair and reseller near my home that have done some work for us. But other than that, yeah, it seems like everything else is just to be tossed. And I'm surprised when things from the past work and when kids of today are interested in those things.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you talk about being tossed, this was something else I had mentioned my little email introduction in the newsletter, where I had basically been looking at a global e-waste report that was talking about the fact that under 20% of technology of today is recycled, and so much of it goes to landfill. And what I thought was kind of fascinating, and I think is really worth noting here, guys, is that there are some companies out there that are creating technology and saying, hey, this is backwards compatible. So what they mean by that is we're going to support your old hardware, even though the software, you know, could be out of date. We're going to make sure that it does work with your old hardware. And I'm starting to see some companies do that. And I really believe that they will be able to lead in the future. And this idea that, hey, you bought a phone a few years ago and the company has decided not to support the software anymore, I don't want to say it's criminal, but we have to start to behave more responsibly. Michael, is that a fair statement?
Oh, I think so. And I think that it could go even one step further. I would love to see if you bring in your old device or whatever it is, will then knock X amount of money off the price. So then it's also encouraging recycling your old devices. And then obviously the company is doing their part as well. And then they could actually start a recycling feature within the company. And then obviously it would be my hope that then the new devices also start to be made from recyclable products and recyclable materials. So I would love to see that full cycle happen actually, and then give those incentives both to people and then giving that ability for companies to be far more responsible as well.
Yeah, and I think it's also worth noting that when it comes to our habits and kind of an overconsumption of technology, that, listen, I feel some responsibility for this as well. I get excited about new and shiny things and a lot of innovative tech in our lives and new features. But I do think that we're kind of getting to the point, Aaron, I'm curious how you feel about this, where we just can't live in a world where we're, you know, just throwing away things, you know, a year after we get them. And it's apparent to me there has to be some changes in the way that we consume things.
Yeah, I agree. And going back to Michael's point, some of the entry points for some of the devices are just too high. And if there's a way to recycle or refurbish old devices, and I know there are phone recyclers out there, but it bothers me that, for example, iOS devices, when they can't physically be updated to a new iOS, and every couple iOS generations, they drop off support for older devices on the back end, and the device is literally useless. If there's a way to refurbish it, reuse it somehow. It could be a better entry point for people on lower income or children or even seniors. I find that with my parents have phones, but they're reluctant to upgrade their phones because they have the mindset of having things built to last and things not being disposable every 2 to 4 years. And then they look at the price tag of the phones, it's a bit too high. So I feel like there's got to be some give in this, and that not everyone out there is ready to shell out for the newest, shiniest thing.
Yeah,
I think also we don't need them. I think it's been interesting. I have some of my friends that have kids. They make fun of the phone that I have and the number of iPhone that I have, because obviously it's not the latest. And I was like, but it does everything I need to. Why would I don't have $1,000 lying around to buy the latest phone. And if I did, I wouldn't be spending it on that. I would probably spend it on rent. Or something more useful. And it's the same thing. I had to get a new laptop. And I remember going in, my laptop died. And I said, well, how much is it to just replace the part? And he said, oh, it's going to be almost $1,000. And I said, well, how much is a new laptop equivalent to what I have? And he said, $3,000. And I said, well, that seems a waste of money. He goes, oh, but it's better. You get a new laptop. And I said, yes, but then I save $2,000 and I use a product that's just fine if it gets fixed. So I think we've touched on that. It's the mentality and it's the way we think about new devices and the way they come to market.
Yeah. And also, you know, one of the things I think about all the time is phones in particular. And, you know, to pay $1,000 or $1,500 for a phone that you carry in your hand and often drop, and yet with one drop, the whole screen can be ruined. To me, it just feels like the worst technology out there. I don't care how great the software is or the camera or anything. And yet we wouldn't accept this in any other vertical, right? If you said to me like, hey, if I turn my stove on and I cook chicken in it, it's going to explode. You'd be like, I'm not buying that stove.
You're like, I'm sorry. That is a hard no.
Yeah. And that, yet here we are. We accept this and these companies do this. You know, phones are dropped. Why can't we create phones and screens where, you know, they don't shatter?
Flip phone.
Right. Exactly. I mean, Samsung has done that. They have a great little flip phone and some are starting to think differently, but I think we need that. Okay. We do have to wrap. I think this is a great topic for social media. So if you're listening right now and you have thoughts on technology that's built to last versus built to fail, please tweet at us at Amber Mac and at mbancroft80. Use the hashtag the feed. And Aaron, where can people tweet their favorite retro tech to you?
I'm on Twitter at my name, Aaron Papernick, on Instagram, Paperboy416.
And of course, this is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B on Sirius XM Canada Talks, channel 167.